Father, thank you, you may be seated. We are going to hear the Thomas West versus Peeble case. This is 12 SC 301. It comes on today for a half an hour. That means each council has 15 minutes. You need to take track or keep track of your time, if you would, please. May I have the entry of appearance, please, from Mr. West?
William Fritchie, 36498, on behalf of Mr. West.
Thank you, Mr. Fritchie. And for the state of Colorado?
It's Ryan Crane, runner 37842.
Mr. Crane, thank you. Mr. Fritchie, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to thank the court for... It only took me 40 minutes to get through North Glen this morning, and wow. The clerk's office was very kind, and somehow I got here, I hope, timely. This court granted cert to review this case, I believe, to resolve the tension between the 1983 case of Peeble v. Castro and later inconsistent holdings made by the Colorado Court of Appeals. The government frames it as the Castro being in tension with the Supreme Court case of Nickens v. Taylor from 2002. I cited in my brief, and I would cite as an example, that not all state courts believe that Nickens requires a showing of adverse effect. I cited in my brief several cases from the state of Illinois that have a per se rule that they do some fine language, I believe, in terms of balancing an automatic reversal when there's a conflict of interest against the holdings in Nickens. The Court of Appeals has set forth a number of tests to be applied. Castro is, of course, a Supreme Court case. Edible and Miera have in common fact that the adverse effect was assumed or easily found. Then you get to the Dunlop case and the Hagos cases. They talk about the words impeding. If the conflict impedes counsel, in MATA, they talk about counsel being hindered by a conflict of interest. And the most egregious standard that I found has surfaced in Peeble v. Kenney, where they suggest that the petitioner, in this case, Mr. West, must show that there was a mens rea on behalf of trial counsel and that he deliberately did things because of a conflict. And I would submit that that test is unreasonably strict. I'm relying heavily on the dissents by Justice Marshall in Kyler and in finding that it's incredibly difficult to get into the mind of the attorney and find out what he did or what he refrained from doing because of an actual conflict of interest. RPC 7.1.7 does not require the showing of an adverse effect, as was pointed out in the amicus brief. It talks about a risk of an adverse effect or a possibility of an adverse effect. And I believe that that rule is consistent with Castro. Mr. West strongly asserts that even though a presumed adverse effect is a minority view, the logic of it is set forth by Justice Marshall and Kyler.
Could I just stop you right there just to make sure I understand? Because of your reliance on Justice Marshall so expressly, you're asking us or suggesting that we already have created a different and more expansive rule than the U.S. Supreme Court has?
I believe that Castro is a more expansive view. I believe that Castro was based upon both the Sixth Amendment and the Colorado Constitution. Unfortunately for us, the Supreme Court doesn't often tell us how the Colorado Constitution differs from the federal constitution, but clearly there are cases that hold that it does, that it's the Colorado right to do that, to have a higher standard. To cite cases as to what the logic is when the Supreme Court says this is a state constitutional finding, There just hasn't been a lot of language to help us with that, and from what I can read, I think the court applies the state constitution and believes that it's a better rule than what the federal constitution says. The case standard...
I'm sorry, counsel, can I just follow up on that? I'm sorry, when you say it's the better rule, what do you mean by that?
I'm saying that the logic of it, the logic behind it, the argument in favor of it, is better law than forcing a citizen in the position of Mr. West to show that, well, my attorney did this, and not only did this, but because he had a conflict and there's a direct link to that conflict of interest. So most states track the language of it must show an adverse effect. The Castro case says that it's presumed. The Curran case follows with that. And that's where I'm making the distinction between the views, and I believe that the holding in Castro is better than the Supreme Court rulings.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly. I've tried a lot of criminal cases, been before Justice Reed Rice many times when she was in Denver, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard, well, there's a mens rea to this crime, but we don't have to prove exactly what the defendant was thinking because his actions speak for themselves. I think that same theory should apply here. When an attorney, as in this case, is in the public defender's office, it's a small public defender's office, certainly not the size of Denver, perhaps the same size as Fort Collins. I mean, it's not tiny, but it's small. They know each other, and clearly, trial counsel knew that several of the key prosecution witnesses in this case were frequent flyers in the public defender's office. They had pending cases in which the public defender was representing them, albeit in a different county. But we're under the old rule here, and I would submit that the reason the Court of Appeals found on behalf of Mr. West was that the knowledge was imputed to Mr. McNulty, and there was plenty of it. Case law makes it pretty clear that the burden of proof upon Mr. West or any other citizen is determined by when the issue is raised. So if the issue is brought before the trial court and the trial court listens to it, at that point, if it goes up on appeal and an actual conflict of interest is found, then the one test of presumed adverse effect takes place. When it's not raised in the trial court at the time of trial, as in Mr. West's case, and the Court of Appeals specifically found, because it was not raised in the trial court, we're remanding to findings of fact on the issue of adverse effect. And at first, this seemed really unfair to me. So if trial counsel doesn't advise Mr. West of the conflict, doesn't advise the court of the conflict that he should have been aware of, and danced around, I mean, he testified that my boss would not be happy because I was clearly outside of our conflicts of interest policy. It's kind of like, because the attorney was double bad, there was a greater burden on Mr. West. I mean, he not only didn't perceive the conflict as he should have, he didn't raise it. And because he didn't raise it, Mr. West is figuratively here today to argue before this court as to why, what the adverse effect was. Had it been raised in the trial court, that argument would not be here. But I would say there are plenty of things in the brief, and I'm not going to regurgitate them, but there were things clearly that Mr. McNulty didn't do. And that's the test, not only what he did do, but what he didn't do. And I set those out there, and there was some issues on cross-examination, some issue on, there was a protection order between two of the prosecution witnesses. They shouldn't have been together. It was never brought up for trial. Things of that nature.
Counsel, could I just go back? I was just thinking over, kind of rehearing in my head what you said about being double bad.
Yes.
And how that, you think, imposes a greater burden. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Absolutely. When I'm reading the Court of Appeals opinion, it's talking about because this issue was not raised in the trial court, we are remanding for a finding on adverse effect. So what I mean by double bad is, okay, he didn't, number one, perceive a very clear minefield that he was walking through. Or if he did, he was trying carefully not to step on any of the mines contained in that field. So, first bad is not recognizing, wow, there's a problem here, because our office not only has, but is representing prosecution witnesses. The double bad is not bringing it before the court. And because he didn't bring it before the court, we're now being asked to show adverse effect, and I think that's greatly unfair.
Because he didn't bring it before the court, you didn't have an opportunity to object, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
I guess that's the link that I wasn't... And therefore, that because there was no objection, there's a different appellate review. Thank you. I think that makes sense.
You're welcome. I've got 4.5 minutes approximately. I'm going to close up here, but I think under any situation in this case, Mr. West should prevail. The rules have now changed. The RPC has changed. This issue isn't going to come up in this context, probably in the future. I did the seminar that Justice Webb did, and he talks about, tell us how we can look in the mirror the next day. Tell us how, if we rule in your favor, it's going to not upset cases all the way down the line for years to come. And I would submit that this case kind of stands on its own. And what I got to people be dug a deal, 275 Pacific 3rd, 772. My faith was restored on this double bad issue a little bit because it says in there, after the conflict arose here, defense counsel engaged in conduct that demonstrates that the conflict adversely affected the adequacy of the defendant's representation. Specifically, he failed to advise his client about the conflict as required by People v. Pettibone. So I do want the court, I am arguing for clients down the road in terms of having to not show a separate adverse effect. But in Mr. West's case, clearly, even if this court finds that and creates a new rule or changes Castro, that Mr. West has already met his burden of adverse effect, and the court can so find without remaining it back to the judge that they're not just.
Yeah, so what is that? What is that adverse effect?
It says specifically he failed to advise his client about the conflict as required by People v. Edibles. So as I read Doug the deal, it's saying in a double bad situation, the adverse effect is there. And that's what we have here. Failure to perceive the conflict and then failure to raise it in the trial court. And according to Doug the deal, which is the Court of Appeals opinion, that in and of itself is adverse effect.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Craig.
May it please the court, Ryan Crane on behalf of the people, of course. Your Honors, this case presented an easy question on cert, and it's an easy question because it's one that's been answered by the U.S. Supreme Court over a decade ago, and that this court has actually acknowledged in 2007. Specifically, what does the defendant have to show in post-conviction review when seeking to establish a conflict of interest, not based on Strickland's standards, but based on the lawyer having a conflict of interest at the time of trial? the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledged in 2002, where in fact specifically held that the defendant, if he's not objected at the time of trial, must show that there was some adverse effect on the attorney's performance that the conflict had. This court, of course, acknowledged that in 2007 in its Dunlap opinion. Were that not clear enough that the Colorado Court of Appeals has also acknowledged that being the rule, I think, 6 or 7 times in public cases in the past 10 or 15 years. And so the only confusion that exists in Colorado at this time is because of a specific Colorado Court of Appeals decision in 2009. That's People versus Curran. As in that case, that the court expressed confusion based on this court's 1983 decision in People versus Castro.
Oh, well, counsel, can I just stop you there?
Yes.
But it's true that we have not addressed Castro specifically given these U.S. Supreme Court cases. Is that correct?
Other than citing Castro as consistent with that rule in the 2000 Dunlap opinion, but yes, not explicitly.
Right. And so, I mean, how do we explain? I believe you're asking us to do that now, and what do we say about Castro?
I think what we say about Castro is it was unclear to most lower courts, or at least a lot of lower courts, after the Supreme Court's Kyler decision. So in 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court first announced this adverse effect requirement. And in 1981, it announced another opinion where called Wood versus Georgia, where its remand order, it was unclear to courts whether or not it was actually requiring an adverse effect. And so you had several lower courts, and this is acknowledged, this confusion is acknowledged in law review articles and Lefebvre, saying it was unclear to lower courts initially whether or not the Supreme Court truly meant to require an adverse effect in addition to the conflict of interest. And so I think what this court should say is it was unclear to a lot of lower courts, courts other than
including us. Is that what you're saying?
I think so, yes, because this court actually acknowledged in its 1985 Armstrong opinion, there appears to be tension between Kyler of the U.S. Supreme Court and Castro a few years later on whether or not an adverse effect is required. And in Armstrong opinion, Justice Quinn also filed a concurring opinion saying that it is, in his opinion, actually, an adverse effect was not required, at least not until the U.S. Supreme Court was more clear. So this court in Armstrong acknowledged there was some discrepancy or tension between Kyler and Castro, and you've got Justice Quinn saying, I'm not even sure, but the U.S. Supreme Court needs to speak more clearly on this question. And the court has done that since then. So you've got opinions, actually, even in Strickland in 1984, acknowledging adverse effect as a requirement, but then also in 1987, 2000, and then as an explicit holding in Nickens in 2002, the Supreme Court said, yes, if the defense did not object at the time of trial, to win a new trial on post-conviction review, he must show there was an adverse effect on counsel's performance, not just that there was a conflict that existed or some mere theoretical division of loyalties, is the way the court phrased it.
Can I get you to address your opposing counsel's argument that we should continue to follow Castro as a matter of state constitutional law?
Sure. Castro was not based on the state constitution. And in fact, Castro cited the Federal Court of Appeals decision as consistent with its holding and as a basis for its holding. And that was a 1981 Federal Court of Appeals decision. So Castro was certainly not based on the state constitution, and this court has never since recognized any other separate state ineffective assistance standard that exists separate and apart from the Sixth Amendment. Apparently two states acknowledge some separate state rule, but I guess the other 48 do not, and they follow the U.S. Supreme Court. The defense also did not properly raise an argument concerning the Colorado Constitution in this case until the petition for rehearing in the Court of Appeals. So I don't think that argument is properly before the court. Certainly it's not the question on which cert is granted. But I don't believe it's a proper argument before the court at this time.
Thank you.
Could I ask you just one question?
So yes, sir.
Just to make sure I understand here, your argument is based entirely on whether there's an objection or whether there's an objection to counsel at the time of trial or the time he acts. Is that true, even if you have a situation like Kyler where you have multiple representation of co-defendants?
The distinction, yes, is always the defense objection at the time of trial. And so trial courts should inquire if they have reason to know of a conflict But whether or not a trial court inquires is not what changes the burden upon post-conviction review. And the Supreme Court was explicit about that in Mickens. And so what changes the burden on post-conviction review is, did the defense object at the time of trial? Does that answer the question?
It does.
And the reason that is at the time, is gamesmanship, really. I mean, at the time of trial, the defense has no incentive to improperly object. If the defense objects at the time of trial, we don't need to take the time to go back and hold post-conviction hearings to make sure, well, was this a fair trial? Did it affect anything later? Did it affect the lawyer's performance? Because we know at the time the defense said, we're not comfortable with this conflict, we don't want to go forward. So the trial court said, too bad, you're going forward anyway. It's a reasonable approach to say, we're going to grant automatic reversal, we don't need to inquire into those things. But where that hasn't happened, we're stuck on post-conviction review, essentially saying, now the defendant has an incentive to say, okay, now I've been convicted. Hey, there's this conflict that I didn't know about, or someone didn't know about, or wasn't raised. And we need to evaluate, is that going to be the basis for automatic reversal? And what the Supreme Court said in Mickens was, no, definitely not. We don't grant automatic reversal just on the showing of a conflict. And if we did, it would promote improper incentives and a sense of gamesmanship, because you've got, for example, a defense lawyer might be concerned of a potential conflict that he or she doesn't believe will actually affect the representation. Do you disclose it to the client? Well, if it's kind of a theoretical out there, I don't think anything's going to happen to that conflict, why not keep it from the client? You might win a trial, and if you don't, raise it later and you get automatic reversal.
I guess the question that I was trying to get at is, do you feel that that's true even in the very narrow situation in which the Supreme Court may have said the conflict is such that the prejudice or adverse effect is apparent and has to be, and therefore we're not going to require a separate showing of that? So you're seeing this as strictly a procedural matter of whether you've preserved your objections, regardless of the nature of the conflict.
I believe that's the case, yes. And the Holloway decision is the situation, that was a 1978 decision before Kyler, but that's the case where the court said automatic reversal. And the court has confirmed since then that is the rule, automatic reversal, where there was a timely objection at trial by the defense, and the circumstance was joint representation of co-defendants at trial. And in Mickens, the court said, that's the only time, by the way, that we recognize automatic reversal as the appropriate rule. And it said, other than that, and including cases like this one, other conflicts, if there was, the standard is objection at trial. And like I said, I think the reason that's the case is we don't really need to inquire. You know, we're always looking, we don't just grant automatic reversal, we're always looking for, was this a fair trial?
That approach, though, presumably, I mean, the objection would come from counsel, I guess. And if the question is the defendant aware of a conflict that his counsel has that would deprive him of effective representation, or if he's not even, I take it according to your argument, he or his counsel somehow has to interpose an objection at the time of the representation, or otherwise prejudice will be required, or some showing.
Right, a showing will be required, and that's the case. That is the standard. I understand the defendant's argument as well, that's unfair. First of all, that is the Sixth Amendment law according to the U.S. Supreme Court, but.
And you're reading Mickens as being,
yes,
standing for that proposition?
Yes, I think in context we have to recognize we're already lowering the burden from Strickland, so we're not requiring any showing of prejudice to the verdict. But we are saying, if no one raised a conflict until after trial, we need some kind of showing that something happened. We don't just grant a new trial. And I think the defendant's point about Delgadillo, where the Court of Appeals looked at, I think is an appropriate case to look at, and illustrates why adverse effect is the appropriate rule, because in that case, and also in Ragusa actually, what the court did was it considered the fact that the lawyer hid the conflict from the defendant as a factor in the adverse effect requirement. So what the court said was, we're going to consider the fact that the lawyer, there was this obvious conflict that arose. the defense lawyer then hid the conflict from the client. We consider that as one factor in determining whether or not this conflict that's been shown had any effect, adverse effect on the lawyer's performance.
Mr. Crane, good morning. Does that mean, if, in a way, is that sort of a bad faith kind of a showing?
The adverse.
Well, you talk about the fact that the lawyer hid. I'm trying to picture the objection. Judge, I object to myself representing my client. I mean, I'm trying to picture how that happens, where the objection can be made.
Well, in Holloway, for example, the lawyer said, Your Honor, I can't represent both of these co-defendants. I've been appointed to represent them both at trial at the same time. I can't do it effectively. And the court said, well, too bad. And it didn't inquire into the conflict. The court should have done is inquire into the conflict, get it on the record, and then give the opportunity, if it's the type that could be waived, give the defendant an opportunity to waive the conflict and make sure it's a knowing and intelligent, you know, fully understood waiver. And sorry.
Well, my point is if the attorney doesn't tell the client, I think it's hard to find where the client should have objected to preserve it. Well, and if the court doesn't recognize it, which, you know, frequently is really hard for the trial court to understand, you know, in this case, that the public defender's office had represented other people, the court probably isn't aware of that.
Right, and so, I mean, the defense, we trust lawyers to do their job in the general, you know, in general. And so there can be situations where I guess a lawyer would be aware of the conflict, but wouldn't bring it to the court's attention or wouldn't bring it to the client's attention. In those cases, one of the things that courts may look at in determining should a new trial be granted is, did this have any effect on the lawyer's performance? If it's some minor kind of esoteric conflict, then probably the answer is it didn't matter. And perhaps, as in this case, the attorney testifies on post-conviction review, I didn't believe it was a conflict, and I didn't have any confidential information, and I didn't pull any punches from cross-examining this witness. But when you've got a situation like in Ragusa and Delgadillo, you've got the attorneys having extensive in-camera communications away from the client with the judge, or even with the prosecutor in some of those circumstances, disclosing all this confidential information about the client, the defense strategy, and saying, we're not going to let the client override us on this. And that's where the court can look and say, you know what, this was affecting the lawyer's performance at this point. This is an adverse effect on the lawyer's performance. And that's what the Court of Appeals determined in those two cases.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Crane.
Just a quick follow-up to that, and sorry, you're kind of short. So, can you just help me understand that you just went about the facts in this case, but you believe there was no adverse effect here?
I believe there's not, and I believe it's a question that's appropriately remanded for the trial court to determine, because it may involve credibility findings and factual findings.
So you agree with it, if you win on adverse effect, there should be a remand?
I believe it should be, yes.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions, I'll be happy to in my time and thank the court for its time and ask that the case be remanded for further proceedings in the trial court.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Crane. Mr. Fish, you have a little bit of time left?
I think 210 looks about right, Judge. I'll be quick. Mr. Crane has indicated that he agreed that this is not a very fair policy. He agreed that there was an adverse effect because of the failure to notify. All right, Mr. McDonald clearly knew he was outside the public defender's conflict of interest policy. He brought in Colorado Springs office to help investigate this case, and it was Colorado Springs that was at the time representing the prosecution witness. So he very well knew. And, you know, it was almost kind of smacks of Watergate, because it was the concealing here by Mr. McNulty. And so, in effect, you know, that is at least one instance of adverse effect. And I would ask the court to look at U.S. Maxwell Sullivan versus Kyler, which 553 F sub, and I have the pin site at 1255, but not the case site. I believe that's when Kyler went back on remand. And they again struggled with this issue. And if they say it is unnecessary to show more than a single instance of a conflict. So I would submit that Mr. West, I think the court needs to address two things in this case. It would be my request. One, address the subject in general, but then also look at Mr. West's case in specific, because I'm here representing him today. And the court doesn't need to remand it. I've cited law in the brief that the court can look at the record and determine, and I think it's very clear in this case, he didn't advise Mr. West of a very clear conflict, and he should not, Mr. West should not be penalized by having a greater burden because it was concealed on a letter by his trial counsel.
All right, thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Crane, as well. This case will stand submitted.